Bruins. Bruins haven't won the Cup in 39 years. Canucks haven't won it at all. I'm Ron Flatter, Fox News Radio.
Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Traveler's Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this Wednesday edition of the Knowing the Truth radio program. We're certainly in for an interesting program today on a couple of fronts. To start with, up first is going to be Warren Cole Smith from World Magazine, even more specifically the associate publisher of World Magazine. And Warren has written a couple of very interesting articles. Actually, one is an article that he wrote, and then the other one is an interview that was that he participated in. I'll have him explain those two here to us in just a few moments. What made it very interesting is, and why it has been picked up by a number of media outlets is, the title of the interview and the title of the article became, A Vote for Romney is a Vote for the LDS Church. That was the title of it, where Warren Cole Smith was making the case that if you were to vote this time around, again in 2012, for Governor Mitt Romney, that you are virtually supporting and adding more credence to the Mormonism, to the LDS Church, the Latter-day Saints Church. We're going to talk with Warren about that article and about the interview that he did and just about this entire subject as well in just a few moments. Let me just tell you who's coming up after Warren. On the second half of the program today, we're going to speak with Ken Klukowski. He's the co-author of a book just recently written. It's entitled Resurgent: How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. So we'll speak with him about that book. Actually, we're going to run a little late on our interview with Warren, try to take a break towards the bottom of the hour, but Ken's not going to be on with me till about 1:40, so we may not start that till a little bit later. If you got a question today for our special guests, beginning with Warren Cole Smith, especially about this issue related to Mitt Romney in the upcoming 2012 election, you can certainly call into the program and participate. Let me give you that number right here at the top of the program. It's 1-888-660-WLFJ. That's 1-888-660-9535. I also have email up and running on my laptop here in front of me, and that email address is kevin@knowingthetruth.org. That's kevin@knowingthetruth.org. My Wednesday program is sponsored by World Magazine, and I put out on my blog today, out on Sermon Audio, by the way, that's sermonaudio.com/knowingthetruth. If you go out there, I put a link to Warren Cole Smith article called A Vote for Romney is a Vote for the LDS Church. And so if you want to read that, or read it while we're going through this discussion, you can go there and just click on that link and it'll take you to worldmag.com. With that, Warren, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Kevin, thank you so much. It's always great to be on with you.
Boy, it sounds like a great topic that you've written about here. I remember the last go around, the 2008 campaign. This was another big issue. This came up then. And even right down the road here from us is Bob Jones University. And the chancellor of Bob Jones at that time actually endorsed Mitt Romney. And so this is something that I think is on the mind of a lot of people here in the Greenville, South Carolina area, as well as the upstate of South Carolina and across the country. Can we vote for Mitt Romney again? And what does that mean? Now, I should say that I think he's got additional problems this time, the additional problems being RomneyCare. We can talk about that a little bit. But even first, I want to discuss the idea of just his religious background and how that plays in. I think that's what you're zeroing in on in your article. Tell us a little bit about your article. Tell us a little bit about the interview that you did, and then we can start making our way through it.
You bet. Well, Kevin, first of all, I want to be really clear that I'm not endorsing a candidate, any candidate, not endorsing Romney or any other candidate. And I'm certainly, not speaking, World Magazine doesn't endorse candidates. We report on what we see going on in the world. And that was really what the spirit of that article was all about. And basically the points that I made in that article were that that evangelicals in particular have some questions that need to be asked and answered about Romney and his faith before I think that evangelicals are going to feel comfortable voting for Romney. It's a political reality, a political fact in the current environment that it's pretty much impossible for a Republican to get elected president of the United States without the strong, enthusiastic support of evangelical voters. Bob Dole, if you remember going all the way back to, 1996, I believe, was against Bill Clinton for his second term, and he was not able to marshal the support of evangelical voters, even though Clinton was fairly weak, and of course he got beat then. And Karl Rove famously said that the difference between the 2000 and I believe it was the 2002 midterm cycle, whenever Democrats made such gains, was the fact that about 4 million evangelical voters stayed home. So evangelicals are they're not the majority. They are not the only voting bloc in the Republican Party by a long shot, but they're an important bloc that not only have to turn out, but have to turn out enthusiastically with their money and with their volunteer help if a Republican is going to get elected. And the point I was making in that article is that Romney has not really fully addressed these issues to the satisfaction of the issues of his faith and his vision of America, in terms of the history of America and what America stands for, in a way that I think is yet satisfying to many evangelical voters. I think one indication of that was the fact that Romney, though he spent more than $50 million in the 2008 cycle, ended up actually winning only a very few delegates and had to drop out of the race relatively early because of his, don't know why, but I think it was because he didn't get the enthusiastic support of evangelicals. He had the support of economic conservatives, but not of social conservatives, and he's going to have to solve that problem this time around. You asked about the article, too, Kevin, if you just indulge me another minute. Sure. I actually wrote that article originally in 2007, before the 2008 election. That article is, at least a longer version of it, has been online for now, close to 4 years. And when a website called Patheos decided that they wanted to do a symposium on Romney, among religious people, they wanted to talk about Romney's Mormonism. They asked me if I would just edit that article and make a shorter version of it for that site. So it's interesting to me that this article is now generating really the firestorm that it has generated over the last week since it's been online, because it's actually an article that's been online in a different version for probably 4 years.
It seems to me that when we think about Mitt Romney, that there are a number of negatives. And when I say we, I'm thinking about evangelicals at large, as a whole. I'm thinking about the negatives being, one was his faith, no doubt about it, that came up in 2008. He's got the additional issue now that I mentioned in the introduction, Romney Care, since the issue, one of the major campaign issues is going to be Obamacare, a lot of people feel it's going to be difficult for Mitt Romney to be critiquing Barack Obama about his health care program when Mitt Romney did pretty much the same thing in Massachusetts. He's tried to draw some distinctions, but I don't think the average person is getting the distinctions there. He also had issues with that he had flip-flopped on his view of abortion and homosexuality over the years as well. So those were his negatives. But it appears that he is garnering quite a bit of support, and I think it's a result of that the economy is so much in focus and fiscal issues are so much in focus. And he seems to be the candidate that has the strongest resume dealing with financial or fiscal responsibility, having been a governor and had some success stories apparently there in Massachusetts fiscally wise. Do you agree?
Well, I do agree with that. Romney has his strongest base of support from fiscal conservatives. There's no question about that. During Romney's tenure as governor, Massachusetts went through what has sometimes been called the Massachusetts miracle, where it was a high tax state with many fiscal problems. When Romney left, it was in much, much better shape than it was. I think there are a lot of people who have confidence in Romney's ability as a manager. And he ran the Olympics, the Salt Lake City Olympics. That was, one of the Olympics that really, along with Peter Uberoth's running of the night of the Los Angeles Olympics, and Billy Payne running the Atlanta Olympics, those three guys are sort of considered by many to be the architects of the new Olympics, the modern era of Olympics, where the Olympics has become massively profitable and an extraordinarily large multi-billion-dollar operation. So I think you're right. As a manager, Romney has a lot of confidence, and of course I even left out a third credential that he has, which was that he was a senior manager at Bain & Company, which is one of the largest financial services firms in the world. So he does have those credentials. There's absolutely no question about it. Kevin, the point, though, that I would make is that while these credentials are important and Romney is right to tout those qualifications, and I think we as voters are right to consider those qualifications. I also think that for social conservatives and evangelicals in particular, those are likely not going to be enough to make social conservatives and evangelicals completely comfortable with Romney. That, as you rightly said, Romney has been inconsistent on some of the issues that evangelicals care most about. Same-sex marriage, for example. It was Massachusetts, you may recall, that really unleashed same-sex marriage on the country. Mm-hmm. It was in Massachusetts. I don't remember now if it was the first or the second state to adopt same-sex marriage, but it was certainly one of the early states, mm-hmm. and it did so with Romney's support. I'd have to look at a timeline to see whether he was actually governor when that took place, but it certainly happened, with his support. The same thing, as you rightly said, with health care. The Massachusetts plan was, Barack Obama has said repeatedly, the model for Obamacare. So, Romney has got some serious questions to ask and answer. And I would also argue, too, that while it is, getting later by the minute in terms of this election cycle, it is early in this sense that there are still a lot of Republican candidates in the race. It is possible to be a front runner on the Republican side of things with 10, 15, 18% showing in the polls. Mm-hmm. And Romney is able, because he does have this strong core base of support, he's got a national network because he ran in the last campaign, he's able to garner, anywhere from 15 to 18% in some of the polls, and in some polls even a little bit more than that. But the real question is, what happens when some of the second and third tier candidates start dropping out of the race and their supporters get redistributed among the candidates that are left. My argument is that, or my concern is, I guess I should say, it's not so much an argument, it's just a concern in looking at the political landscape, is that most, many of those votes, perhaps most of those votes, will be redistributed to someone other than Romney. Mm-hmm. And not only that, just within the last 2 weeks, we've seen, you know, candidates get in the race that are also, I believe, sensing this void. I heard as recently as today that Jim DeMint now, who had previously said he was not going to run, is currently considering
run. Yeah, I didn't hear that.
So that would have a huge effect in South Carolina, especially, which is a, you know, which is obviously an early state. We've got, you know, conservative activists like Richard Viguerie, who has become a real spokesman for conservatives, you know, who have been promoting a Jim DeMint candidacy. Jim DeMint said that he was now considering it, but just based on the outcry that he's seen. So I just think that while Romney is a front runner now, but for all the reasons that we, you know, both of us have mentioned, that that, you know, his liability with social conservatives is very real, and he's going to have to address it if he wants to remain a front runner as we get deeper into the campaign season.
Okay, with those other issues aside, just for a moment, that I agree are major issues that Mitt Romney would need to overcome sufficiently in the mind of conservatives and Christians in order to get that nomination. Romney Care, his original support for abortion and the homosexual or the marriage, same-sex marriage in Massachusetts. Those things aside, his faith is what the article that you wrote really deals with. And it kind of begs this question, if I could draw this question out of the articles and the interview. Does the religion of a candidate matter? And even more specifically, is Mormonism any worse than any of the other religions besides Christianity? Now, I would say that Islam, of course, would be something that we could make a case for would really be dangerous because of they've set themselves against the United States so strongly. And I would think, you know, obviously Islam would be problematic. But other than that, is Mormonism any worse than any other religion that we could name that a candidate could hold to? And would that automatically disqualify him in the mind of believers, do you think, in the minds of evangelicals, in order to run for the presidency?
Well, let me answer that question in a couple of different ways. Let me just start off with theologically. Is Mormonism different from other religions? I think the answer to that question is, you know, an unequivocal yes. I mean, the beliefs of the LDS Church are not consistent with historical biblical Christianity. And the thing that's interesting to me about that question, because as you know, Kevin, because you've read some of the articles that have been posted online, I've been interviewed a great deal by Mormon press. I mean, I've been quoted in Religion Dispatch's Mormon Channel, which I believe is one of the articles that you have posted on your site. Mm-hmm. And I actually turn that question back on my questioner whenever I'm being asked it by a Mormon. I would say, listen, if Mormonism is no different from being a Southern Baptist or a Presbyterian or a Catholic, why don't you become a Catholic? Why don't you, Mr. or Ms. Mormon, become a Southern Baptist or a Methodist or a Presbyterian? And whenever I phrase the question in that way, even Mormons admit that, well, yes, you're right. There are some significant doctrinal differences between the LDS Church and historic mainstream Christianity.
But I'm asking a slightly different question, Warren. I'm asking, I'm saying that among those that differ from Christianity, Is it any worse than any of the others that differ from? I'm not saying that it has any similarities or a number of similarities that would make it like Christianity. I'm saying that it is different, but there's a number of religions that are different. Is it any worse than any of the other ones, Hinduism, Buddhism, or any other, is it specifically anything inherent within Mormonism that makes it even more dangerous or more egregious that a candidate would be of that religion?
Well, let me answer that question quickly by saying the answer is yes. But let me back up just a minute and say that even if the answer was no, that Mormonism is no different from Islam or Hindu in terms of its differences with Christianity, I would still, from a political point of view, have to ask this question. Do you think a Muslim could get elected president of the United States? Do you think a Hindu could get elected president of the United States? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to both of those questions would be a resounding no, that Americans, when they elect a president of the United States, they are looking for someone who not only shares their political views on a range of issues, abortion, pornography, homosexuality, and so on and so forth, but what they also understand about the presidency is that it is, to use Theodore Roosevelt's language, a bully pulpit, that it is a position which, if you will, is a symbol of what it means to be an American and what America is all about. That we vote for someone who's the president of the United States who essentially shares the values of the American people. And I think values go well beyond agreement on a narrow range of issues. I think it is a sense of a shared history and a sense of a shared culture. And to move on to the second part of your question, Mormonism has a very distinctive view of American history. It has a view of American history, for example, that America was originally settled by members of the lost tribes of Israel, that Jesus, in fact, visited America, those are just two among a number of idiosyncrasies that Mormonism teaches about American history. And, you can argue that, well, not all Mormons believe that, or you could even further argue that even if Mormons believe that, does it matter that they believe that? Will it affect, for example, the way Mitt Romney views Israel or some of our policies related to Israel? The answer to that question is, I'm not sure. I don't know, but I believe that those questions are going to have to be asked and answered by Romney very specifically if he expects to get very far with evangelical voters and with American voters in general during this election cycle.
Mm. I remember some of those were asked last time around, how would his Mormonism impact his decision making in the Oval Office? And I remember him dealing with that and saying that although, a general, not very specific answer to it, but saying something like that he does hold to the Mormon faith, but that he would be the president of the United States and he would consider everything that was good for the presidency. Right away, when this issue comes up, many people go to Catholicism because it was a big issue. We don't realize this. I think many people today don't realize how big of an issue it really was that John F. Kennedy was Catholic. And many people saying that to have a Catholic president would have been, bad for the country for a number of the reasons that you've already cited. Now, some people would say, well, Catholicism is just another denomination within evangelicalism or within Christianity. But I would, and I think other people would argue that it is a completely different religion altogether. What would you say if somebody said, hey, are you saying that a Catholic couldn't be in that position as well?
Well, that's a great question, and there's several ways to answer that question. One would be that no matter what you believe about Catholicism, one of the things that is a historical fact, Kevin, and not my opinion or your opinion about Catholicism, is that John Kennedy indeed did have to deal with that question. Mm-hmm. If you remember, he made a famous speech to the Houston Baptist during his campaign, where he, and that speech was famous at the time, and it was it has widely been considered by historians to be a turning point in his in his candidacy.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, irrespective of what you believe about, you know, Mitt Romney's Mormonism, I think to argue that it doesn't matter and that it specifically doesn't matter with the American people in their decision-making process is just shows a real disregard for historical fact, for the way Americans make their decisions about the presidency of the United States. Americans have to be comfortable with the man or woman that is going to be sitting in that Oval Office. They've got to have a sense that that person shares their vision of what America is all about and has and shares their core fundamental values. And that's why, for example, that Kennedy had to make that speech to the Houston Baptist. That's why even that Barack Obama had to make a speech about race in Philadelphia. Now, you know, it was obvious that Barack Obama was a black man from the day he got into the race. He went on to say that the fact that he was black would make no difference. But guess what? Even that became an issue that he had to address specifically with a very famous speech in Philadelphia just months before the general election. The American people need to hear from their from the man or woman that is going to be sitting in that White House. They have to achieve a level of comfort about this. You can argue that it's right or wrong. You can argue that, you know, Mormonism, Catholicism, whatever, being black doesn't matter. Well, then you could even further argue that it shouldn't matter. My only point is, like it or not, it does matter, and there's plenty of history to indicate that it does, and Romney is going to have to speak to that question specifically if he wants to percolate above about 20 or 25% in the polls.
Mm. I think it's interesting in the article that you point even to, from a theological standpoint, the most problematic point that Mormonism holds, and that is continuing revelation, that they believe that the canon is not closed, that we don't just have the 66 books of our Bible, 39 in the Old, 27 in the New, but that they have these additional books that have been added. And you're the only person that I've ever seen argue then from how that view of continuing revelation could impact and affect decision-making in the White House for the candidate running, i.e. Mitt Romney. So very quickly, just tell our listening audience how that would how that could possibly impact it, especially since you end the article this way. You say, for me, that alone disqualifies him from my vote because Mormons believe in continuing revelation. It is possible that the future LDS church will renounce its heretical beliefs and come fully into the fold Orthodox Christianity. But you point to the idea there again about continuing revelation.
Well, the idea of continuing revelation is that you identified very eloquently what it is, Kevin. The way it has manifested itself in the Mormon Church over the years is that, you know, for example, Mormons were a polygamous religion, and they since renounced that. At least some sects of Mormonism have renounced polygamy; others have not. Also, blacks could not serve in Mormon churches until 1978, whenever the church, supposedly got a new revelation, and they erased that that restriction as well. So my point is that in making that point about continuing revelation is that you know, we see in Romney's flip flopping sort of a manifestation of a belief that that there is no core fundamental objective basis for truth in decision making. That truth is negotiable. That absolute truth changes over time. And that alone again should cause evangelicals who believe in the truth of Scripture to have some concerns. And I would also say that it also should cause us to look with some apprehension even on those issues where Romney might happen now to agree with us, and ask the question, how reliable are his positions, even whenever he happens to agree with us? We know, for example, that now all people change their views over time. I mean, I'm not embarrassed to admit to you, Kevin, that I voted for Jimmy Carter when I was 18 years old in 1976.
Sorry to hear
that. But young people have certain views. They mature. They get a view of the world. They become wiser. But these are views that Romney held as recently as 5 or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. These are not the views of a callow youth who had not seen the world. These were the views of a sitting governor, a man who by then was in his early to mid 40s, and the idea that there is no objective view of reality, there is no objective truth that is reliable and that we can base our fundamental beliefs and values on, is troublesome to me, and I think Romney's going to have to address this issue if he continues in the race.
Warren Colesmith, ladies and gentlemen, he's a journalist and the author of the book, A Lover's Quarrel with the Evangelical Church. It was his article that we were talking about today. The article was entitled, A Vote for Romney is a Vote for the LDS Church. Always interesting to speak to Warren Colesmith, often provocative too, and so really got us thinking here. I think he's made a lot of good points in this article about this particular candidate. So, Warren, thank you very much for taking the time out. Thank you for thinking so deeply about this subject and for taking the time out to visit with us on the program today to explain that view.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Kevin.
Okay. Again, Warren Colesmith, that was. We're going to switch gears here in just a couple moments. We're going to continue with the idea of politics somewhat as we go through the program today, but we're going to turn to look at the idea of a new book that's coming out called Resurgent, How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. So we're going to look at a little bit different aspect here than what we were just talking about. This should be interesting. My guest will be Ken Klukowski, and we'll be back in just a couple moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. For more information about today's program, the radio ministry, and the resources we offer, go to www.knowingthetruth.org.
One thing you can say about the news is it's never news for long. The stories we hear are changing all the time, and that's why you need to tune in to the next Janet Mefford Show. We'll bring you the most important news of the day every day, inside the church and out, and always from a Christ-centered perspective. Plus, we want to hear from you, so don't miss the next edition of the Janet Mefford Show. We'll see you then.
Weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 on Christian Talk 660 at 92.9 FM.
It's great pizza for a great price. So pack up the family and head over to Stevie B's near Walmart on Woodruff Road in Greenville. At Stevie B's, you'll find friendly faces and at least a dozen pizzas out at all times. Or you can order a pizza and they'll make it fresh just for you at no extra cost. So visit Stevie B's today.
Hi, this is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and I want to take the time to thank John, Ruth, Carlos, and the good folks over there at Stevie B's Pizza for their support of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
As a young teenage boy, I didn't even know what autism was. How do you even spell that? A few years later, I heard that a friend's cousin's son had been diagnosed with autism.
I still wasn't sure what that really meant.
When I went to college, my roommate's brother had autism. When I moved to the city for work, my best friend called me and told me his son had been diagnosed with autism. We were both in shock. I still remember the day I walked into the house and saw that look on my wife's face. I knew something was wrong. I'll never forget how I felt when she said, "Our son has autism."
Autism is getting closer to home. Today, one in 110 children is diagnosed with autism. That's a 600% increase in the last 20 years. Learn the signs at autismspeaks.org. early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Well, welcome back into the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling, and we're in the second half of the program now. The first half, we're speaking with Warren Cole Smith. He's with World Magazine, but I think that this particular article that we were discussing was kind of separate from that. Just as a journalist, he was speaking, and as an author, he was speaking about Mormons and Romney presidency. And what evangelicals or how evangelicals should be thinking about that. He raised a lot of good, interesting thoughts, things that I think we should certainly consider as we consider who's running this time around. One of the interesting comments he made, and kind of just an offhand statement, is that he mentioned, I don't know, we didn't cite his source for that, but he mentioned that Jim DeMint had apparently said that he was considering a run. Now, previous to this, Jim DeMint, the senator here from South Carolina, had said that he had ruled it out, that he was it wasn't appealing to him, that he was going to continue to do what he has been doing, which was supporting other candidates. He was tremendously helpful in the midterm elections and a lot of the work that he did there. And so a lot of people had thought, well, he's just not going to do it. But from Warren Cole Smith, we just heard a few moments ago, apparently Jim DeMint is considering that run. I think it would be a great thing. I think Jim DeMint would be an excellent candidate and somebody that we could get behind. From everything that I know about him, he's been on the broadcast with me a number of times, and from what I see and know about him, I think he would be an excellent candidate. Let's switch gears just slightly here. There's a new book out, and the title of this book is called Resurgent. It's How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. It's actually co-authored. It's co-authored with Ken Blackwell. Ken's been with me on the program before as well. He's a leading conservative. He was a mayor of Cincinnati, Ohio. He was also the Ohio treasurer at one time. He's a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. He's a fellow with the Family Research Council and so forth. And then also the co-author is Ken Klukowski. Ken is a lawyer and a constitutional scholar. He's also a research and fellow at Liberty University, as well as with Family Research Council and the American Civil Rights Union. He's a legal contributor for the Washington Examiner, and his scholarship and legal briefs have been cited in courts and journals at prestigious law schools, including Georgetown and Yale. By the way, you know, the constitutionality of Obamacare is currently before the U.S. Courts of Appeal, the Fourth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, and so forth. And it's actually Ken Klukowski's briefs that he has filed that are being argued in order to strike down the individual mandate that is required in the Obamacare law. And so Ken is deeply involved in that issue as well. And so it's a pleasure to have him on the Knowing the Truth radio program today. Hey, Ken.
Kevin, thank you for having me.
Ken, tell us a little bit about this new book. Sounds very interesting, but I'm sure you can do a much better job explaining it and giving us a synopsis of it than I could.
Well, Kevin, the book is Resurgent, How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. And in the book, it's my co-author Ken Blackwell and I. We're talking about what constitutional government looks like today. After Barack Obama was elected, we got this terrible overreach of power by the federal government. Many aspects of it, in fact, are unconstitutional. Mm. And millions of Americans awoke to that fact, both on economic issues, and they tend to gather in Tea Party events, and also on social issues that you find so much going on in the churches. And so this book is to show, yes, what's going on is unconstitutional, but it's not just one party. Both the Democrats and the Republicans have moved away from constitutional government, though not in the same way and not to the same extent. So it's talking about both parties need to come together. If the opposition party wants to really help and serve this country, because we're facing enormous challenges, economic challenges, cultural challenges, and national security challenges, any one of which, Kevin, by itself, any of those three, could end our country as we know it, that it's not enough just to vote Republican. We need to have constitutional conservatives that will take us back to the brilliant system of government with which we have been blessed in this country and that has made us the most prosperous, most free, most powerful nation in the history of the world.
You chose the title resurgent, which brings to my mind almost immediately like the surge that took place in Iraq or something along that line. What exactly were you trying to convey with that word resurgent?
Great question, and we tackle that in the introduction chapter to say, you know, there's three ways you can answer it. On the face of it, people looking around, it looks like the Republican Party is resurging. You look at the 2010 elections, and it looks like, okay, Republicans are making a comeback. But we argue that that's just on the surface. That's a little too shallow. The issue is that conservatism is resurgent, and Republicans are benefiting from that. Conservative understandings of the economy, of government, of individuals, of family, of faith. But then we go a third step and say that whether the conservative movement becomes truly resurgent is going to turn on whether the U.S. Constitution is truly resurgent as the supreme law of the land. And if so, then we might be able to turn our ship of state around and tackle the extremely serious problems that we're facing as a country that we set out in the book.
I think many Americans at street level, where I would consider myself, think that there are some sort of safety net or something built in that when you talk about this overreach from this administration, the current administration, and from the Republicans as well, that there is some way to correct this. It'll go through a court system or some other means where this will get corrected. Is that a false impression?
Well, it depends on what you mean by it, because I'll tell you, in Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 of the book, we do in Resurgent explain what two of those checks are. One is what we saw in Living Color in November 2010, and that was a historic voter backlash, that millions of Americans woke up to what was going on and they took action. The other is, and this is critical, this is the biggest chapter in the book is Chapter 6. That's on the courts, and especially the Supreme Court. And we start out by saying that the U.S. Constitution is only as good as the Supreme Court that interprets it. That is intended, the Supreme Court, Kevin, is intended as a check against abuses of the Constitution by either of the elected branches, either the Congress or the President, and on many issues, even by states. But that's only if you have a majority on the U.S. Supreme Court of constitutionalist judges, judges who interpret the Constitution according to the original meanings of its terms and are faithful to interpret and apply it regardless of their own personal political preferences. So the courts here are central. And one note that we are sounding is that every American needs to take every presidential candidate and every Senate candidate and hold their feet to the fire about what kind of judge are you going to nominate? What kind of judge are you going to confirm? Because if we don't get the right people on the courts, our Constitution will be reinterpreted to authorize everything from Obamacare to cap and trade to same-sex marriage to taking away your Second Amendment gun rights.
You write in the book, mentioned that econs, SOCONs, SAFECONs, that they unequivocally need each other. Explain those acronyms that I just used and then why it's so important that they understand that they have to work together if there's going to be real valuable change in this country.
Kevin, in Chapter 3 of Resurgent, we explain how those three, economic conservatives, social conservatives, and national security conservatives, or econs, SOCONs, and SAFECONs, how we're in a modern myth, the idea that those are somehow different things or that they're at odds with each other, or worse yet, there are people trying to redefine conservatism to only being about fiscal issues to the exclusion of social and security issues. The reality is that constitutional government is a unified understanding of the proper role and power of government, and that in that the each of those three naturally flows from faithfulness to the constitutional text. And I'll give you one real quick example, is on the economic issues. Wherever families fail, wherever families fall apart with broken marriages or no marriages and fatherless families, you get an unstoppable political will to grow government to fill the void, to provide security for the home, to provide handouts and welfare for the home. If America's families fall apart, you will not, absolutely will not, be able to restrict the size and the cost of the central government.
You have a statement in here where you say to be pro-traditional marriage, pro-value, and pro-life is to be pro-business, pro-wealth creation, and pro-freedom. That basically you can't separate these two things. You can't just say, oh, well, I'm pro-life and I don't care about those other pieces, or I'm pro-creation or pro-business and I don't care about these other issues. All of those things you're arguing must be considered together.
That's right, because they naturally reinforce each other for exactly the reasons we were talking about. And this is chapters 3 and 4 of Resurgent, where we're at, where we show how a married family with children is the most efficient and productive microeconomic unit of economic growth and investment in this country. It focuses economic energies towards long-term investment, towards responsible stewardship of resources, towards towards instilling in the next generation values of honor and trustworthiness and hard work and thrift. So we show that America's economic prosperity comes both from our common set of moral values that manifest itself in our courts of law, in our business dealings, in our contracts and property rights, and also in terms of the in terms of individuals and families, of giving people something worth fighting for and something worth working for. And I'm sure that every one of your listeners out there knows someone who, when growing up with them, was a good-for-nothing, he was a wastrel, he was either a heavy drinker or he was into drugs or whatever. As soon as he had a child and had a family, who turned his life around, started working hard, even working overtime, to take care of his family, and is now a respectable member of society. We all know people like that, and it takes place on a nationwide scale, and that's the unbreakable bond between economic prosperity and strong families.
Speaking of family, one of the things that you advocate in the book is a family flat tax. Is that the same as the flat taxes that has been spoken about for years, or is this uniquely to be applied to the family?
It's very similar. We say in Chapter 7 that there are two things without which we cannot fix the fundamental fiscal and economic problems we're facing. One is a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and the other is a family flat tax, and that's two things. First of all, that a flat tax, whether you call it family or not, America's tax code is fundamentally broken, and it needs to be three things. It needs to be short, it needs to be flat, and it needs to be participatory. And what that big word at the end is that when you have a tax code where half of the people, half of the voters, very importantly, half of the voters don't pay any federal income tax, then they're fine with electing people that are going to raise taxes because it's no skin off their back. When you have 60 or 70% who are paying taxes but keeping it low for everyone, then when a member of Congress says, well, if you elect me, I'm going to go raise taxes, they say, well, the heck you are. You're talking about taking money out of my paycheck. So the key is to have taxes that are low, but low for a vast majority of the population, so that everyone says, you better have a darn good reason if you're going to suggest a tax hike, because otherwise I'm not going to stand for it. Also, it needs to be short, because every provision in the tax code, Kevin, is a form of government control. It's the tax equivalent of the spending earmarks, where if you have a high-powered lawyer or lobbyist, you can get a special provision for you, but that shifts the cost to all the ordinary folks. The issue is that for every provision in the tax code, that's done to manipulate you either with a carrot or a stick. A short tax code with none of those gimmies and gimmicks is what leaves people free to make their own decisions. And it needs to be flat. We showed that the economics are overwhelming, that a graduated income tax punishes investment, savings, and success. And so what we need is a tax code that is flat, that is simple, and that is participatory, but that needs to be focused on the family. Mm. We're not a society of individuals. We're a society of families. And the reality is that if a family decides to have one parent work and the other parent stay at home to help raise the kids, there shouldn't be a penalty in the tax code for it the way there is in the current tax code. If people are having families, if they're having children, they shouldn't be punished for that the way they are under the current tax system. So we talk about how to take a flat tax and put it in the context of being family-focused and family-friendly to help America's families.
Mm. I think one aspect of the tax system that I never hear many people talk about, or seldom do, is because it's so complicated, and maybe we could even argue corrupt to the way that it's been put together, I think that there are a large number of people that are finding ways around it. You know, they're not reporting their income, and then that works towards the detriment of the country as well. And they're just fed up, and they're just saying, you know, it's so complicated, and they're taking so much that I'm not going to report what I'm making, and so there's a lot of money that's just not being reported at all. I got to ask you the last question here, Ken, just because of our time frame. In the end of this, you're really calling for action, for citizen activists to stand up and fight in order to revive this country's glory. Is that a fair statement to say?
It is. The purpose of the book is to transform its readers, hopefully your listeners, Kevin, to make them into citizen activists, to show them what's going on, what the Constitution says about it, what they can and should demand of everyone running for governmental power, whether it's a local county guy or the President of the United States and at all levels in between, to make them voters and activists and to inform their judgment with the Constitution on all of these issues so that they can be part of the solution to get this country back on track to a system of government that has been a singular blessing for this country that's made us the leader of the world.
Mm, well said. The book sounds very interesting. I'm going to go ahead and repeat it here for the listeners in just a moment, but I want to thank you for visiting with us here on the program. It sounds like it's very good. I haven't received a copy of it yet, but when I do, I'm going to be sure to read through it and maybe have you back on the program with some questions from our listeners as well.
We'll get one to you straight away, Kevin.
Excellent. Ken Klukowski, thank you very much for being with us on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. That was Ken Klukowski. He is constitutionally, his arguments about the trying to strike down the portion of the Obamacare law is currently the arguments that are being used. That part of the law is referred to as the individual mandate. It's Ken's work that is being used right now in order to undermine that horrible law that was passed about the Obamacare just last year. And so he's done a tremendous amount of work on this issue. He's a lawyer and a constitutional scholar. He's a research fellow for Liberty University, as well as for the Family Research Council and the American Civil Rights Union. He's a legal contributor to the Washington Examiner, and he's also, his scholarship and legal briefs are cited by courts and journals at all sorts of law schools, such as Georgetown and Yale. And so just a tremendously helpful constitutionalist, somebody who wants to see us go back to the Constitution. The name of the book was called Resurgent: How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. And it's a hardcover book, and you can find out, get some details about it. Just Google that or go to Amazon, and you can get a copy of it. It's also put out by Simon & Schuster, and so you can go out to their website. website. It's www.simonsays.com. That's www.simonsays.com, and you can get a copy of that book. Again, it's called Resurgent, How Constitutional Conservatism Can Save America. Remember, folks, as we talk about a number of these issues from a Christian perspective, we need, as Christians, to be involved. As Ken was just talking about, we need a simple understanding of what the issue is and how that compares with what our Constitution says in this country, and I would add, what the Scripture says. And as we compare all that together, that then will tell us what we need to do. Remember, the Lord Jesus Christ said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Join me tomorrow. Mary Kaysen is going to be with me on the program. We're going to talk about girls gone wise right here on Knowing the Truth. See you then.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.
Life-changing teaching and talk for the Carolinas and Georgia. Christian Talk 660, WLFJ, Greenville, Spartanburg, Anderson.
Fox News Radio.